this movement towards freedom for all those who have been oppressed and all those in the struggle. Yeah, yeah, check it. There were lights and sirens, gunshots fine. Cover your eyes as I describe a scene so violent. Seemed like a bad dream. She laid in the blood puddle, blood bubbled in her chest. Cold air brushed against open flesh. No room to rest. Pain consumed each breath. Shot twice with her hands up. Police questioned, but shot before she answered. One panther lost his life, the other ran for his. Scandalous the police were as they kicked and beat her. Comprehension, she was beyond, trying to hold on to life. She thought she lived with no arm, that's what it felt like. Got to the hospital, eyes held tight. They moved the room to room, she could tell by the light. Handcuffed tight to the bed, through her skin they bit. With guns to her head, every word she got hit. Who shot the trooper, they asked her. Put the mace in her eyes, threatened to blast her. Her mind raced till things got still. Opened her eyes, realized she's next to her best friend who got killed. She got chills if they told her that's what she would be next. Hurt mixed with anger, survival was a reflex. They lied and denied visits from a lawyer. But she was building as they tried to destroy her. If it wasn't for this German nurse, they would have served the worst. I read the sister's story, knew that it deserved a verse. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free, so dig it, y'all. Awakened up, walkie-talkies crackling, not saying where they taking her. Though she kinda knew what made the ride peaceful was the trees and the sky was blue. Arrived to Middlesex prison about 6 in the morning. Uneasy as they pushed her to the second floor in a cell. One cot, no window, face to hell. Put in the basement of a prison with all males and the smell of misery, seedless toilets and centipedes. She exercised, paint, and began to read. 2 years in a hole, her soul grew weak. Away from people so long she forgot how to speak. She discovered freedom is an unspoken sound, and a wall is a wall and can be broken down. Found peace in the panther she went on trial with. One of the brothers she had a child with, the foulness they would defeat her, hoping she'd lose her seed. Held tight knowing the fight would live through the sea. In need of a doctor, from her stomach she'd bleed. Out of this situation a girl was received, separated from her, left to mother the revolution and lactate to attack hate, cause federal estate was built for a black fate. Her emptiness was filled with beatings and court dates. They fabricated cases hoping one would stick, and said she robbed places that didn't exist. In the midst of threats on her life and being caged with Aryan whites, through dark halls of hate she carried the light. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free. Yeah, I often wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free. So dig it, people. Grandmother would bring news that she had had a dream. Her dreams always meant what they needed them to mean. What made them real was the action in between. She dreamt that Asada was free in their own house in Queens. The fact that they always came true was the thing. Asada had been convicted of a murder she couldn't have done. Medical evidence shown she couldn't have shot the gun. It's time for her to see the sun from the other side. Time for a daughter to be by her mother's side. Time for this beautiful woman to become soft again. Time for her to breathe and not be told how or when. She untangled the chains and escaped the pain. How she broke out of prison I could never explain. And even to this day they try to get to her, but she's free with political asylum in Cuba.
Listen to my love, Messiah. We're born from the same mother. asking me about freedom. Asking me about freedom. I'll be honest with you. I know a whole lot more about what freedom isn't than about what it is. Because I've never been free. I can only share my vision with you for the future about what freedom is. The way I see it, freedom is the right to grow. It's the right to blossom. Freedom is the right to be yourself.
Good morning, WPFW 89.3 FM. You're on with Community Watch and Common, and we just opened up with Common's A Song for Asada. And at the end of that song, you hear Asada in her own words talking about freedom and what freedom means and what freedom is and what freedom does. And for me, freedom is the right to hate. I feel alive when I'm doing it. I'm inspired by it. So we got some of my favorite haters on with us. Dr. Ball still in the building. Yeah. I'm fresh off our mix with I Like. Yeah. And I believe we still have on the lines with us Dr. Frank Wilderson and Baba Daruba Ben Wahad.
I'm still here, bro.
All right, good. Because the hate was flowing so much over, we wanted to continue this conversation.
Yes, and thank you both for that.
And, you know, the airwaves are built for 60-minute intervals, but hate extends it to about 120 if you can. Figure 1/12 of the day spent hating can't be a bad day. So let's get right back into this conversation, and then we're going to open up the lines to callers who may want to interact with y'all and have some questions to engage with y'all. But let's go back to this idea that we just had there was just a prison escape in Mexico by El Chapo, right? Mm. And it becomes this really huge discussion in this media environment about Mexicans. And Frank, when you were talking about Mexicans petition to be white in the Supreme Court, you know, it was probably Donald Trump's ancestors that was on the court saying, nah, y'all can't be white, right? But here we have this discussion of El Chapo breaking out. And I want to go back into the period, if y'all can talk about what the media climate would have had to do with this idea that Asada just got broken out of prison. Mm. What might that media climate have been like, if you remember anything about it, or what would the media have to do to suppress that information that a political prisoner has just escaped?
Could I weigh in on this?
Daruba, we got you on so you could weigh in on that, man. I thank you for asking permission, but you the one that granted. Please do.
Listen, I was on my way to the Federal House of Detention from Clinton Prison up near the Canadian border, maximum security prison. And of course, you know, I had a very contentious relationship with the prison guards up there on numerous occasions. So, and I spent like 7 years in the box off and on. A couple of those years was up there in Clinton. Anyway, I had a counterintelligence suit in, and I was being subpoenaed to come to court on my counterintelligence suit, which ultimately got me out of prison. And the police that came up to get me were part of the major case squad and the joint terrorist task force. Now, for people that don't know the history of these things, there's been these special units developed in New York City over the years. First it was tactical police force, then it was the joint terrorist task force, the major case squad, and all of these squads. These were all elite units of detectives that were pulled from around the New York City metropolitan area to form an elite unit. This particular group, the Major Case Squad and the Anti-Terrorist Squad, their whole thing was hunting up. This was their thing. This is how they got their reputation. This is how they got their money. Their whole thing was to carry out a domestic program of repression against black activists, especially those in the black underground and on the armed front. So I was coming to court. They came to get me to court, take me to court. And I had this big police escort. It must have been about 3 or 4 police cars. And I'm sitting in the car with 2 of the police officers who killed Twyman Myers. And Twyman Myers was a BLA soldier that they were deathly afraid of. I mean, you would make a Hollywood movie out of this brother's exploit. And when I was on the way down, the news came over the police radio and on the regular news that Asada had broken out of jail. This was the same day she got out that they were bringing me down to court. And You should see the expressions on these police, on these cops. You know, they didn't know, you know, before they were bantering back and forth and bragging about how this shotgun is the one that killed Twyman, and this one did this, and they did that, and, you know. But when that news came on the radio, and when it came over there, police band, you could see the change, not only in their body language, but in their very eyes, and in their demeanor. They were shocked about this. They were so shocked that, you know how white boys are. They try to revert to some gallows humor, you know, or some morbid sense of humor. And one of them made a comment, and they said, "Well, I see your sister got out of jail. Your sister escaped." I said, "Yeah, man." I said, "She might be down the road waiting for you."
So you just started counting down on them. 4,
right, three, right, right.
2.
Just started sitting in the back of the car. Now, go now.
So,
abracasada.
The smirk came off his face, because if there was an organization and a group or individuals who were so committed to what they believed to go into prison and take one of their comrades out, This bold ill for them, because that meant that we had total disregard for their institutions, for their security, and even indeed for their own lives. So it was even. It was a sense that they lived a life of fear that they've been putting on us all of our lives. And that's what the brother professor there was talking about, how we have to live our lives in fear. We have to live our lives completely different. He was talking about how white supremacy and the system of capitalism, you know, although they exist hand in hand, nonetheless, people of color, and black people in particular, are particularly threatened by the violent nature and the violent programs and the violent policies of law enforcement, of the police state. So, but this is one of the things I wanted to say. The absolute look of fear on their faces, fleeted on their faces only for a moment. And then they got back into their macho white boy law enforcement bag, you know. "That will get her." "Nah, you didn't get her. You didn't get her. She's in Cuba. She's been there for a minute. I went and saw her twice. You didn't get her." So these are some of the old guards, police officers, who later on, with the establishment of Homeland Security, became advisors to a whole new generation of policemen and law enforcement personnel. And in fact, at the police academy in New York, they have a course on the first and second BLA war. They have classified them into BLA War 1 and BLA War 2, based on the people in the first cadres who were initially arrested in 71, myself and others, as opposed to those who came afterwards in 74. And this is the origin of the homegrown terrorism idea, that they feared that the political prisoners in prison, that they would educate, they would radicalize other inmates. So therefore, the political prisoners were almost always kept in isolation. We were never allowed to be more than one of us in one institution at a time. And when some of us took our shahada and became Muslim, then this took on a whole new twist, because now you had foreign-born Muslims from Egypt, from the Middle East, who became chaplains, who became Muslim chaplains. And these Muslim chaplains became part and parcel of a program they call PRISAP, Prison Activist Program. This was a federal program designed to train correction officers and correction guards on how to deal with political prisoners and how to deal with Muslim political prisoners in particular. Because it was in the early 1970s, in between 1971 and 1975, when the Dalit Alam movement arose in Brooklyn and arose on the East Coast, where thousands of young black men and women became Orthodox Muslims. And if you remember, I don't know if any of you remember the Brooklyn Sporting Goods store expropriation by some Muslims who went into a Brooklyn gun store and were trapped in there in Hell's Siege, were besieged in there, and a police officer was killed. And they claimed, the brothers said, and I was in prison with them, that the reason why they were arming themselves was because the U.S. government had began instituting a program of infiltration into the Dar es Salaam movement with foreign-born Muslims who were agents of U.S. intelligence agents and Egyptian intelligence agents. So this whole beginning of anti-Islamophobia and idea of homegrown terrorism and self-radicalization came out of the repression of the Black Liberation Army, the FALN, the Puerto Rican Liberation Group, and other such armed groups. And once we were in prison, they developed a whole program to deal with us in prison and our families in terms of surveillance, in terms of dealing with our movements inside the prison system. So today, even today, when we look at Abdul Mutakim or Mumia Abu Jamal or any of the brothers in prison, especially the Muslim political prisoners, when we look at them today, they're still undergoing the same type of surveillance, the same type of procedure. Of course, CLASSAC has been discontinued, but they have developed other programs in order to deal with that. So I just wanted to say that Assata's escape from prison triggered an enormous amount of recalibration of the prison system to deal with Black political prisoners, their families and their relatives, and later on with Muslim political prisoners. So therefore, a lot of stuff that we saw at Abu Ghraib, the torture and the mistreatment of Muslims there in the prison there that became a scandal, when you look at the people that performed these tasks, they were correctional guards who were on National Guard duty, who were mobilized. They had expertise in correction. And so these techniques of torture that they used to subject us to in the wintertime and waterboarding and sensory deprivation was all tried out on Muslims who were of African ancestry then. And this buys into what the professor was there was saying about how there's an anti-Black component to all of law enforcement dealing with Black folks. And in the terms of Muslims, there's an anti-Black component. And to the point where the recent law enforcement reports on self-radicalization and Islam in America is that that they define, when they break down the population census of Muslims in America, they refer to African-American Muslims as indigenous Muslims. Now, remember this. They refer to us as indigenous Muslims. That's very important to understand. They don't refer to us as North African or Egyptian or from the subcontinent. They refer to us as indigenous. In other words, being of here, evolving in here, okay, in this country. Just like we talk about indigenous people. They considered African-American Muslims indigenous Muslims, which means that the anti-Islamic sentiment that they expressed on African people has a racial component because many of the slaves that were taken from West Africa were Muslims.
Daruba, thank you very much for that, for clarifying that. And I just want to remind people that that this is Jared Ball here with Dr. Haight for Community Comment. We're on with Dr. Frank Wilderson and Daruba bin Wahad, formerly of the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army, formerly a political prisoner of 19 years. And Dr. Frank Wilderson, on top of all the writings that he has done and the activism he has done, is also formerly involved with the armed wing of the South African Azanian freedom struggle against apartheid. And I just wanted to say, if we didn't know this, but if the two of you have not formally met, we want to help create that, and we'll happily take credit for that on the air here. But Daruba bin Wahad, Dr. Frank Wilderson, because, you know, Daruba, I think Frank in many ways continues to be your sort of academic intellectual counterpart, having also been involved in some of the similar real work that you have also done in the past yourselves. So, we're happy to, we were excited to have you both on, and I want to make sure that you two get a chance to acknowledge it, you know.
And we're also forming the Haters Advisory Board.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly what this is.
And we have some applications for you two to review to figure out who's who.
You know, I just want to say it's such an honor and a pleasure to be on with you, Brother Daruba. I can't tell you how much your work, your life work, has meant to me, and people like you and Jalil Montakim and Nahanda Abiodun, and of course Asada. I was 14 in 1970, and the split in the Black Panthers and all the things that were going on were really confusing to me. But if it wasn't for, you know, the New York chapter of the Black Panthers and key individuals out here on the West Coast, I can't, you know, like Geronimo and Jalil, I think that the demise of the Black Panther Party would have been psychologically debilitating for someone like me. But I think that what I'm trying to say is that the BLA took this to another level, and the work that you did really educated us. And I just wrote a blurb for the back of Jalil Montakim's next book. And I ended the blurb by saying, you know, an army of slaves doesn't get the recognition that a national army gets. But I want to say, you know, to you, thank you for your service and all that you've done for people like me.
Mm, well said. Well,
brother, I just want to say, Jared, that, you know, I'm indeed honored too, to be on the program with this brother, because I have checked out his writings on anti-black and his analysis, and believe me, you don't alienate me from the left, brother.
Okay. Well, it's a California thing where you know you can't get people. Black people out here are always giving, you know, giving to alleviate the oppression of other people. And when we try to say that we have a particular relationship to the police that you don't have in the same way, I think the response should be, well, hey, black people, tell us more about this so that we can be as supportive of you as you are of our immigration struggle and different things like that. But instead the response is, oh no, Frank, you're trying to be divisive. So
to spin off on that, you remember Izvestia and Pravda that used to come out of the Soviet Union before it collapsed? The two publications, Izvestia and Pravda?
Oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, they used to, they regularly wrote about racism and color in the United States. And, of course, they opposed the nationalist concept and idea of self-determination for black folks because they viewed racism as a component part of dividing the working class and yada, yada, yada. So, you know, the same old mantra from the white left. And one of the things that they would do is that, you know, they would never recognize any of us as political prisoners.
Ah, interesting.
No, they didn't recognize any of us as political prisoners. And this was after the Angela Davis case and the CPUSA, you know, coming to her defense and getting her out of that situation. You got to remember, Angela Davis's case was rose to prominence because of the arms struggle,
exactly.
Of the underground. Yeah. Okay, people don't understand that. People assume that Angela Davis was in the Black Panther Party, et cetera. She was part of the general repression. That's not true. She was never in the Black Panther Party. She was a child of the Communist Party. And but having said that, my point is that it's Vestia, and this is the Soviet Union. That when the United States was chastising the Soviet Union for its gulag. And Reagan met with Gorbachev or whoever it was in Reykjavik, and the Soviets through racial discrimination in the face of Reagan, they used every case imaginable. They went into the Scottsboro syndrome, what I call the Scottsboro syndrome, and what we have today, which is a continuation of that, is leadership by victimhood. I think we talked about that on the TV, Jared.
Yes.
Leadership by victimhood. How victims of police racism and brutality and murder have been thrust to the forefront as the arbiters of politics, as the individuals who would chastise the radicals for taking to the street or forgive the oppressor for murdering their children. You see, so this leadership of victimhood has its auspices in that same in that same milieu, in that same background. So it's very important for us to understand that when we were disconnected, when these movements and Frank could probably speak to this too, that these movements today, these young folks in the streets who are staying in the streets, who are changing the dialogue by their mere fact of them protesting and staying in the streets, and bless their heart for that, you know, may they be successful. But we know that right there is not going to change the paradigm of racist power in the United States. That's Paul. And in fact, while the United States is a garrison state now, that's going to be viewed as supporting terrorism. That's going to be viewed as weakening the police apparatus and ability to keep us, quote, all safe. Now, when they use that term all safe, Brother Frank was pointing out, they don't mean us. You know, and so what I'm trying to say here is we're these movements are disconnected from the radical tradition, from this radical history that we're talking about right now. So because they're disconnected from it, they are condemned to repeating the same mistakes that were made, first of all, and second of all, they're not availing themselves of radical tools of resistance. They're being completely hamstrung by their own limited politics. And Brother Frank was talking about how Asada's book did more to wake up young folks and get them to begin to perceive their own lives in reality to the police state than anything else he's ever did with them. That's the quickest track. And why is that? Because Asada's life, just like the life of Frantz Fanon, you know our friend Mark, who's a black psychologist, and they have influenced an entire generation of revolutionaries and revolutionary thought and Pan-African international. These figures, Fanon, in terms of academic and psychology and book-wise, and Asada in terms of giving women, young women, young black women, an alternative to the Oprah Winfreys and the Angela Davises and all of those. This is a woman that embraced exerting a political consequence on the enemy whenever they shoot us, whenever they kill us, whenever they brutalize us. And
Daruba, and so, you said in the past that she was actually skilled at that.
Yeah, she became quite good at it. I mean, there's no question. There's no question that Asada, once she went underground, she went underground as a medical cadre. You know, that was her role when she first went underground. But as events would unfold, and some of us were arrested, some of us were killed, and certain ranks was decimated, she had to assume a greater role in leadership on a certain level. But but she was a sterling example of. I mean, we have sisters like her right now in our midst. We just haven't seen them shine. Mm-hmm. They haven't been presented with the historical moment where they have to step forward yet. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I assure you, just like that woman climbing that fag pole on that symbolism stuff, you got some sisters out there that's no joke, and they haven't been empowered yet because they're separated from the radical traditions of people like Asada or Robert Williams or the Black Panther Party or the Maroons and all of our history of resistance. And once they lock into that and they connect it to their lives, to their own living experience, then, I mean, you got to look out for them, man. They don't be no joke.
This is WPFW 89.3 FM, Community Watch and Comment on Friday. You are live with Dr. Ball, Dr. Hayden in the building, and we have Dr. Frank Wilderson and Baba Daruba Ben Wahad by phone. Typically, we're taking callers at this point. We want to get Dr. Wilderson, Frank, if you can weigh in on the media moment and what this might actually look like in Azania when the ANC confronts South African troops and how the media has to make sure that none of the victories in these small battles and skirmishes that the MK can claim actually get publicized within the media landscape in Azania?
Well, Azania is a bit complicated because I'm no longer supportive of the party that I was a member of and that I was elected official of. I think that the African National Congress has lived up to, and this is a negative condemnation, it has lived up to everything that France Fanon warned us about when he talked about the problems of the national bourgeoisie in the wretch of the earth. And so I'm not sure. Do you mean the media now or the media back in the, when I was there in the 80s? And
when you were there in the 80s and you were, you know, labeled public enemy number something.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the interesting thing about that is that what happened is that somewhere around 1990, well, first of all, Chris Hani was assassinated. And when he was assassinated, what you found was that the Communist Party, which had the most, like 90% of the people in Mkhonto-Wassies were actually card-carrying members of the Communist Party. The Communist Party had 50,000 members. And every person in the Communist Party had to join the ANC in order to radicalize it towards socialism. And 90% of the people in Mkhonto were also SACP, Communist Party people. But they were so aligned to the Soviet Union that when Chris Hani was assassinated, what you found was that, and Chris Hani was assassinated and the Soviet Union had been dissolved for the most part, people started jumping ship because Nelson Mandela started calling in regional leaders, and I was a sub-regional. I was elected to a sub-regional council, which would be like a political commissar, a five-person political commissar for Washington, D.C. and surrounding areas. But regional people like state political commissars and national political commissars were called in and told that should they follow through on what Hani's standing order, which was to hit certain targets in the event of major people in our party being assassinated, and Mandela's people said, should they follow through on that, that they will have no jobs in the new South Africa. And so that caused a really big split in MK, and sometimes that split, I'm very sorry to say, led to internecine violence. And ultimately, what Thabo Mbeki became vice president, and F.W. de Klerk became the co-vice president, and they formed an intelligence committee to rid the, when we finally got the vote in 1994, to rid the new South African dispensation of what they called ultra-leftist and ultra-rightist. And I'm really sorry to say that Nelson Mandela actually sanctioned that intelligence committee, which involved people who were from the former special branch of the Nationalist Party, as well as people who were part of a particular component of MK in the past, which was called the internal security component. And in the past, these people in internal security had done the job of ferreting out agent provocateurs and ferreting out spies from the Nationalist Party, black spies. Now their job was to, in the words of the document, neutralize their mutual problems, which is to say the problems of Eugene Terblanche and the Afrikaner Volksstadt movement and the far-right conservative and the people on the left, what they called ultra-leftists, which are people who had been aligned with Chris Hani, who were trying to push for a total revolution. And I was one of the people on that list. So the media actually got their marching orders from my former comrades, and I'm, you know, that's just the truth of the matter.
Well, you know, that you know, I'm glad Frank pointed that out. How You know, I've always been, you know, Alambé Brass was my was in many ways my mentor in terms of my Pan African consciousness,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of, you know, I traveled to the continent of the Congo with him, and he was about the only person that could get me on the stage with certain people at the same time.
I hear you.
Because that's the type of unifying factor that man was. May Allah be pleased with him. This methodology that Frank just pointed out, how this happened in the United States as well, and I think Frank was well aware of that in terms of the left and the Communist Party USA. It happened in relationship to the Black Panther Party. That's a whole other show, Jared. But
you're right about that. We're going to be on for the next 3 days if you guys got time to just stay on with us for a little while.
Yes,
we don't have time for another show. We got now.
Yeah, that's a whole nother script. But the methodology that Frank pointed out, we could see it with certain organizations. They were encapsulated. We know that the Latin American hunters, the CIA, trained them in the expertise of encapsulating leftists and revolutionary organizations and using them as a break on the real revolutionary movement.
Yes.
And using them as a site to siphon off the what they would consider violent, prone guerrillas and terrorists. You see? So, you know, I'm glad Frank pointed that out about the AFC, because I've been like one of the few people that talked about Mandela in less than endearing terms. I remember having a conversation with Hugh Master Caleb about Ahmaud Mandebo, and he said, look, Mandebo, you know, he lets them come and take pictures with him and donate and give money to his foundations and stuff like that. He said, but the fact that apartheid benefited the racist settlers more than it did the African masses. The destruction of apartheid, the dismantling of it, at least its facade, the dismantling of it into the type of national security state that it is now. You got to remember, as Frank has just pointed out, that they made sure that they went after the revolutionary, that the revolutionary and those who wanted to take liberation process to its final and logical conclusion, you know, were purged, were demonized, was called ultra leftist, and all of these things. I think Frank pointed out earlier when he was talking about Fanon, and he said that the racism of the colonial of the colonial state is not an individualized thing. It's on the entire people. So every settler in the state is part of that enforcement of that colonial paradigm. And it was Amilcar Cabral who made it very clear that by how that's the case. Amilcar Cabral said that African liberation is a reassertion of the historical continuum of the African. It's a retaking of their historical continuum. Africa's historical continuum was interrupted by colonialism and by European and outside forces in collaboration with what we would call a comprador class today, but what we know are traditional leaders back there in the continent. You know, I lived in Africa for 15 years, so I know what's taking place with the chiefs and these families that think they own the state and that they have a right to be president like forever. You see,
D, if we can, I want to open up the lines and take just one or two calls, if we can, and just get you all to give some feedback on that. Caller, we got you on the line now. If you could turn your radio down, that'd be perfect. And if you can share your comment, thought, question, if it's for our guests, we can have our guests respond. So you're on the line now.
Good morning, my brother.
Good morning, Tesfa. I want you to get succinct with us, please. All right.
Thank you. Talking about the truth, about what's happening to our life and the reality, makes them say you are divisive. where else can you go other than your life, other than what's happening to you, other than the truth, other than the reality? If that makes you divisive, it's good. I am speaking to my people. And that's what I'm saying. They are the ones who are really divisive because they are racist. And they will tell you, why do you do this? But the reality demands, the truth demands that you stay and you keep unity. We need to unite. We, black people, need to unite. And to Ethiopians who accept the promise of democracy, the promise of elections, the promise of accusing the genocidaires, and now finding out the truth that all this promise was a lie, was cheating, I want to say, Ethiopians, please stop ethnic politics and unite as Ethiopians.
All right. Thank you very much, Baba Tesfa. We're going to take one more caller before we get right back into the conversation. Caller, you're on the line. It's Dr. Haight, Community Watch and Comment, Dr. Ball in the building, Dr. Frank Wilderson, Baba Daruba, Ben Mahad on by phone. What's your comment or question, story of the week, what you think about?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is Sister Fahima. I want to say greetings to Brother Daruba. I don't know if you remember me, but I was part of Frontline Artists' literary group. The Brother Baid Muhammad had spearheaded back in the early 90s, and we did a number of events for you. As we speak...
Yes, yes, this is the Frontline Artists with Brother Zaid in Newark.
Yes, sir. As we speak, Nana Shebe is being funeralized at Rankin Chapel, and she was very active with the PNC, the PAC, rather. And I don't know if your guest, Brother Wilkinson, I think his name is, who was lived in South Africa during the struggle in, around apartheid, and I was wondering if he was familiar with Nana Shebe and some of the activities of the PNC, PAC. I know he was active with the ANC. And perhaps someone there could speak to that.
Yes, I, again, my apologies in the sense that, well, not apologies, let me just explain that in the late 80s and the 90s, there was a real wall, a division between the PAC and the ANC, and it was largely ideological, but it was also having to do with the global situation in which the PAC got arms and support and kind of a technological and guerrilla training from people like Mugabe in Zimbabwe and from the Red Chinese. And the armed wing of the ANC and the more militant divisions were actually supported by the Soviet Union, various countries in Comic-Con and Cuba. And so I'm just going to, this is history, so I'm just going to tell it to you. There was often a lot of fighting between the ANC and the PAC for hegemony, for the heart and soul of people in places like where I taught in Soweto. And that manifests itself in the universities, in the white university where I taught, in Johannesburg, Fitz University, and the black university in Soweto where I taught. So that's the bad news. The question of whether or not we're moving to a non-racial society, which was the ANC's line, or whether or not we're moving to a black African Azania, where the slogan was "One Settler, One Bullet," which was the PAC's line. However,
it's because we ain't have enough bullets.
However, I want to say that towards the let's say the period of 1990 through 1993, I saw something that was really encouraging in places where I was teaching, and that was young people who were either cadres in APLA, the Azanian People's Liberation Army, or had been cadres in MK, or who were in the student movement of the PAC or the ANC, started coming together for a program to make the university system ungovernable, so that the universities would not become handmaidens of the new capitalist IMF dispensation, which we were trying to move into. And so what I want to say is that what was heartening, but it was cut off too soon, was that the project of national ungovernability on campuses to force universities to de-link from their role as handmaidens producing knowledge for the military state and for capitalism, that brought a lot of people who were in high school and in college from the PAC and the ANC together for a common cause, which was emboldened by the fact that once we got to CODESA, the negotiations, we saw, and the assassination of Chris Hani, we saw a kind of a conservative alliance between PAC political leaders and ANC political leaders that was that smacked of betrayal to the youth. And so that never was allowed to flower, but it was a moment that I took great encouragement from.
And Frank, we never got you the chance to hear your thoughts on why Asada is a hero. Would you mind sharing that? We got about 5 minutes left, so we'll get concluding thoughts from both of you.
Well, I think that as a teacher, it's very difficult to, you know, one of the things that you can do on as a kind of in the humanities as a leftist type of person is you can say, you know, the Palestinians should have their land back and they should be free of Israeli domination. But one of the things that you can't, and you can have, like, I studied under Edward Said at Columbia, and, you know, he was for the destruction of Israel to produce a new secular state, not based on religious membership or racial membership. And he got away with that. Now, I can't get away with saying that the United States of America has no ethical basis for existence. That just brings me a lot of trouble. I do it, but it's like the ceiling of academic discourse stops at that. You can only go so far as to say that there are discriminatory practices in the United States which need to be changed. And what happens with Asada's book is that you find a way to talk to students about the unethicality, the lack of ethics of the existence of the U.S., the lack of ethics of the existence of the police, and they can be drawn into that conversation without having, and it helps to break down the feelings that they come to school with, which is to say that they feel and they know that the entire world, the entire state, and all the police are just against them because they exist, not because they break any.
Could I comment on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Real quick, so I'm going to let you finish with Asada because he asked you. That's the sovereignty of violence.
Yes.
That's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about the sovereignty of violence in a garrison state, in a national security state.
Exactly.
They have a complete sovereignty over violence.
Exactly.
And how they dispose of that violence, that means that all citizens are potential terrorists.
Yes.
Every person in the society is a potential criminal. And therefore, the sovereignty of violence is then distributed amongst the people according to the mores and the cultures and the historical iconoships of white supremacy. So that's what that touches. You go right back in a circle on what Dr. Frank was saying when he said that when he was talking about breaking down anti-black and what that means. So it's the sovereignty of violence. And so when you meet that academically in academia, when you meet that is, you can't question the sovereignty of the state. There's no dialogue. There's no philosophical discourse that's going to say that America is illegitimate state. But we know historically that the United States was a European settler state, and it evolved into a republic through genocide and acquisition of land, in turn, i.e., the use of violence, the sovereignty of violence for white supremacy, the sovereignty of European assumption that they can go take what they want and do what they want. You know, that's one of the reasons we're on a program like this that says we hate who we want. We hate what we like.
Exactly.
You see? So yeah, the sovereignty of violence.
That's true, though. You're trying to hate everything about this country.
Yeah, and Asada's book opens up young people to express that in ways that I don't think any other book could do, because it's theoretical, but it's also written in a way that can be accessible, and especially, you know, with young black women in the class, it touches their experiences. You know, it oscillates between the kind of present tense chapters, the odd number chapters of being a black revolutionary, and then the even number chapters of moving up from childhood, girlhood. And that is a way of allowing or helping young black women and black men just kind of access the own traumas of their life, and being okay with going in the direction of Dr. Hate. One little anecdote. It could also press the professor into a place that he didn't know he was going to go. When we were teaching it, and 9/11 happened. What was interesting is that the morning of 9/11, I was standing outside my classroom door, and students were walking down the hall. And what I could see coming down the hall towards my classroom was that the whites and the Asians were looking really dejected, you know, as they were walking to the classroom. And the black students, this was at UC Berkeley at the time, they had a kind of swagger in their step, you know. And and I was like, oh, I can't swear on the air. So I said to myself, oh,
thanks,
you know,
Frank.
What?
Thanks, Frank.
And the black students, one black student got to the said, we did that, S-H-I-T, you know.
We did that.
And it was like an existential moment for me, you know, because it's like the teaching's like coming home to roost. And they, to a person, wanted to slap five with me as they walked into the room. Now, I slapped five with them, and I'm, you know, acknowledging that energy and that excitement and that joy of seeing America attacked and get labeled as some kind of terrorist, and the other half of the classroom then is completely alienated from me. I don't slap five with them, and the black students are saying, well, do you walk the talk?
Well, you know,
Frank DeRuba, I got to slap five with both of y'all.
Yes, indeed.
And listen, we have to pick up five. We got to wrap
but
here.
But I did slap five, I want to say.
We, all right, thank you very much.
But listen,
we hear you, man. We got to roll, man. We really got to roll, man. We've gone way over here. We apologize for cutting you off. We know we hate to do that, too.
Not a problem.
Yes.
Not a problem.
But we will pick this up. We will pick this up later.
Y'all won next week. Listen, this is WPFW 89.3 FM. This is Dr. Hate.
Can I just say one quick thing real quick?
Yes, please.
I know we're over time here, but I just saw Ski Muhammad walk in, and I complain all the time about being overlooked. This brother put out something on Facebook the other day. Please go check out his Facebook page. Ski Muhammad is a giant, and we don't
Tell us here that the 49th anniversary of the BPP is going to be here in Atlanta, and I need him, and the committee, we want him to do a workshop here.
There it
I
is.
Want him to holler,
Skier, did you hear that?
There it is. We're working on that. But I just want to acknowledge
him. Cut his mic on.
We want to acknowledge that Askia is one of our overlooked giants, and he's right here in the building, and I appreciate him.
Big 10-4.
Yes, indeed. All right, he heard you very much.
There it is.
All right, so we'll catch you in the whirlwind, everyone.
All right, peace out.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, that's WPFW 89.3 FM, Community Watch and Comment. We got Baba Skia with the news, Ida B. Wells with Don't Forget the Blues. Thank you very much for tuning in. Follow up with us next week. And
Wells
online,
or Campbell, same thing. It's all good.
Yes.